So chapter 5, verse 7. Be patient, therefore, brothers, until the coming of the Lord. See how the farmer waits for the precious fruit of the earth, being patient about it until it receives the early and the late rains. You also be patient. Establish your hearts, for the coming of the Lord is at hand. Do not grumble against one another, brothers, so that you may not be judged. Behold, the judge is at the door. As an example of suffering and patience, brothers, take the prophets who spoke in the name of the Lord. Behold, we consider those blessed who remain steadfast. You have heard of the steadfastness of Job, and you have seen the purpose of the Lord, how the Lord is compassionate and merciful. But above all, my brothers, do not swear either by heaven or by earth or by any other oath. But let your yes be yes, and your no be no, so that you may not fall under condemnation. Well, the Christian life, well lived, is characterized by, in particular, patience and steadfastness. Patience and steadfastness. And these are the two big ideas we're going to think about now, patience and steadfastness. Now, often when you say things like I've said before, you can have the death of a thousand caveats, and I suppose this is the ballast to a lot of other things we talk about when we talk about being active. That activism is good. It is good to be involved in the church you're a part of. It is good to be involved in summer camps or prison ministries and things that happen outside of our church. There's a sense in which impatience is good. There's a sense in which you can have a healthy dissatisfaction. It's good if you want to get things moving, if you want to get things going. Momentum is something that happens in any organisation, doesn't it? And if you remember your, I think, third year physics, I say nervously in front of Stefan and Fran and Craig and Nick and others who know science, momentum is MV. That's right, isn't it? Momentum is mass times velocity. So the kind of the stuffness that we are, numbers, our maturity and so on, times the speed we go at, and you start losing that, you lose momentum, and sometimes momentum goes the other way. And you know that as a church, don't you, and other things you're a part of, that sometimes you feel the momentum's going the right way, and other times it stalls. So it's good to be impatient in that sense. Last church I was a part of, I got a visit from our MP, strangely, the MP of Birkenhead, and I can't remember if someone told him of me, or whether I said it of me, that I am impatient. And he said, that's good, because in Birkenhead, without impatience, nothing would ever happen. So impatience can be good. But more often than not, it is not good, and it is unhealthy. So you need patience. You need patience to wait on God's timing. So act, do stuff, but act patiently. So the two big ideas in this passage is patience and steadfastness, and they have an outcome, and that is fruit and blessing. That patience leads to fruit and steadfastness to blessing. So a lack of patience and steadfastness forfeits fruit and blessing. Now this term, for those of you who have not been here, this term, we've been working our way through James's letter, and we're coming to the end, and James is tying up the themes that we've been looking at, and a bit more of that next week. So he ends with the themes that he started his book with: joy in trial. And because of trial leads us to steadfastness, and steadfastness, he says in chapter 1, leads us to being complete. So this whole letter has been about being about patient, consistent living. So he's talked about wise living, how we receive wisdom and go on receiving wisdom. Consistent living, so having received this wisdom, we live consistently. That we hear from God, we hear wisdom, and that leads to doing the right kind of thing. The series we called Faith That Works. Your faith does work, and your faith is put into work. He's talked quite a lot about speech, and speech exposing what's on the inside of us, what comes out, just exposes what was there in our hearts all along. And he's touched on this issue of worldliness. Our attitude towards money in particular, and those with it. And this is all about patient, steadfast living. And patience leads to steadfastness. And both are put at risk yet again by our speech. Well, let's, as we start, have a bit of definition. What do I mean? What are sort of dictionary definitions of those words, at least Bible dictionary definitions of those words? Well, patience means self-restraint. Patience is self-restraint. So you want to jump in, but you're patient. And particularly here, self-restraint that does not lead to retaliate or to act inappropriately. That's patience. And steadfastness means you don't succumb under suffering. That's steadfastness. So patience works in a time frame, doesn't it? By definition, it is that there's a time issue, that you are waiting for something. And here we're repeatedly told that thing you're waiting for is Jesus' return. Jesus' return is the information we need to be patient. And Jesus' return is the context of our patience. So I'm going to split the section in half, verse 7 to 9 about patience, verse 10 to 12 about steadfastness. But both sections start and end, which is why I think there are two sections, both sections start and end with a reference to Jesus' return. So the sections both start with it. So verse 7 talks of the coming of the Lord. Verse 11 starts about the end. Actually, it says in our version, I think, the purpose, but the word there is the end. It can mean end, purpose, or something like that. The sections end that way as well. So verse 8 talks about the coming of the Lord is at hand, and verse 10, the judge is at the door, and then verse 12 ends talking about condemnation, and the word there is the same word that we had earlier of judgment, and linked to the word judge. So it's the same ending. So it starts and ends thinking about Jesus coming back. So we look at these two characteristics of the Christian life lived well: patience and steadfastness. Patience leads to fruit, verses 7 to 9. Steadfastness leads to blessing, in verses 10 to 12. So patience that leads to fruit, verse 7 to 9. Now remember the context. The section is topped and tailed with the Lord coming, the Lord at the door, the judge at the door. And in that context, he's saying, don't panic, be patient. And he illustrates this by talking about the farmer. It's frequently, isn't it, the Bible uses farming as an illustration. So the farmer waits. He waits for the fruit, which he says is precious, and he is patient. He says he waits for the early and the late rain. So this end of the country, the east side of the country, where I've lived most of my life, and we're glad to live most of her life, it rains when it rains, doesn't it? If it feels like it, it rains. If it doesn't feel like it, it doesn't. The other side of the country, where I've just been and where I lived for 8 years, it rains. That's what it does. It just rains. Now, Israel's like neither parts of the country. Israel has two rainy periods, the early rain and the late rain, as they call it. So in October, you have the early rains, and this is a good time to plant and where the seeds germinate. And in March is the late rains, where the grain or whatever is swollen for harvest. You need both to get a harvest. What can the farmer do about it? Nothing. He can plant and he can harvest, but the rain is God's work. And often this sort of illustration we find in the Bible, don't we? The job is to plant and to harvest, but much of it is largely out of your control. You can plant, you can harvest, but the quantity and the quality of that harvest is largely out of your control. An observation I've made is that about ministers, is lots of ministers have as a hobby something they'd never have imagined before they went into ministry they'd have as a hobby, of gardening. And if they don't like gardening, they like brewing their own beer and wine. And some of you know about me. We have a little garden, so you can tell what I do. And the reason why they like gardening and they like and perhaps prefer brewing is it's a lesson in patience, where you do something and then you wait, and then you have a wonderful, usually, end product. Sometimes you wait and stuff goes down the drain. But you do something, there's a bit of work, and then you can't do anything about it. And then you have an end product, but within the year. Ministry is far longer. And many things that we plant, we won't see in our lifetime. We've just been away on a camp, a Christian family camp thing, and one of the talks was talking about the faith of Moses' parents. So by faith, they were willing to have a child, and they protected him and so on. Now, by the age of 40, up to that point, Moses looked like a disaster. It's 80 when his ministry kicks into action. His parents' faith what they did was never seen by them. Sometimes the fruit of what we do, our ministry now, is not seen, frustratingly, in our lifetime. At least for me, I pick my berries in June, and I can drink my wine at Christmas, or elderberries next Christmas. There's a time frame in which I can see the end product. Churches can be impatient, but Jesus is coming. Be like the farmer. Now, this kind of is an obvious thing to say, isn't it? But if there's a call here to be patient, it must mean that there's a temptation and a cause not to be patient. And we're given here some warnings and guidance about patience. So verse 8 is about your own heart, and verse 9 is about your fellowship. So in verse 8, it's about your heart. He says, establish your heart. Now, this word here that gets translated establish is the same word that is used about Jesus when he talks about he set his face to Jerusalem. This is my plan. I'm setting where I'm going off to Jerusalem. So we are to establish or set our hearts off on that direction where the end of the verse goes, Jesus' return. We're focused and single-minded. And James likes that sort of language, doesn't he? He keeps using this very single-track focused language. So in chapter 1 he says, don't be double-minded and blown around, and keeps warning us against inconsistency. No, he says, establish your heart. Fix it on the harvest, whenever that is. Fix it on the harvest, on the Lord's return. Notice a contrast to what we looked at a couple of weeks ago in chapter 5, verse 5, and now chapter 5, verse 8. Verse 5, he talks about our hearts being fattened for judgment. And now, here, our hearts are set and readied for the future. So which way are you preparing your hearts for that future? I saw it, I can't remember where, it was a while ago when I was thinking about this, but I saw a quote about the plans of today should be set on the certainties of tomorrow. Your plans today set on the certainties of tomorrow. Well, what are the certainties of tomorrow? Politics? Well, if they were ever certain, they're not now. There is nothing certain about how long a government will last for before we have the next vote, referendum, or something or other. And the changes and the things that are offered may happen, but they might not happen. And if they happen, they may be good for us. Well, they might not be good for us. How do you make a plan along any of that? Jesus' return, though, is a certainty. It is, I was going to say, set in stone. It is more certain than that. And being patient means being deliberate about where your heart is focused. Literally, what is your heart set on? Now, all this is an internal thing. It talks about our hearts. But it's also an external thing, external of ourself. We need to watch our fellowship, how we relate to each other. So verse 9, do not grumble against one another, brothers, so that you may not be judged. Behold, the judge is standing at the door. You may not be judged, and the judge is at the door. Now, at times, the times that require patience, that there are precious points on us, aren't there? There's likely tensions in church that leads to grumbling. And speech and tongue has been a repeated issue through James. It's so easy when things have gone wrong to go and grumble at someone. It could be someone in the church leadership. It could be that someone in church has said, I've got a good idea. Why don't we fill in the blank? And then it's gone wrong. And so people grumble at them, assuring they'll never do anything again. Well, look back to chapter 3, verse 18. It says, and the harvest of righteousness is sown in peace by those who make peace. I'll read that again. A harvest of righteousness is sown in peace by those who make peace. And related to that, someone said, harvest the harvest we're talking about, is sown in the soil of fellowship. Harvest is sown in the soil of fellowship. So that means there is no harvest where there is no peace. Where fellowship is, where there is no fellowship, there's no fellowing going on. Where it's compromised by moaning. Psalm 133, perhaps we should have sung it this morning. Psalm 133 talks about how sweet it is when brothers dwell in unity. But it's not very sweet when they're not. But it is understandable, isn't it? It is all understandable. Remember, the context of this book is that there are tensions inside the church and there are tensions outside of it that the church is feeling, and that's how they're responding, is how why there are tensions. And this section on patience is it's all needed, isn't it? Because the church is working hard, as many churches have done ever since. They work very hard and it comes out with no signs of any progress. And so there's pressure from members, there's pressure from society, and it spills out in all kinds of frustrations. And those frustrations spill out in words. You know the sort of thing. Well, if they would just come more frequently, if they'd pull their weight, it's just some of us are doing everything. If only that person over there would pull their weight a bit more. If we didn't have to fill in the blank to keep those people happy, then it would be better, wouldn't it? And James's message is, well, don't. Just don't do that. It's understandable, but don't do it. Why shouldn't we do that? Is it because there are, from our experience of being in churches over decades for most of us, is it because of our experience and what statistics would back up that kind of behaviour has a devastating effect on the church? Well, that is true, but that is not the reason. Here's the reason. End of verse 8. The Lord is at hand. Verse 9, the judge is standing at the door. A few years ago, we looked at the letters. Actually, I think we looked at it a couple of times. We've looked at the letters to the churches in the start of Revelation, where Jesus walks among the church, and he knows our thoughts and our words, those spoken and those not spoken. And he judges. He judges churches now. He withholds or he removes blessings because they grumble. Judgment comes. In 1 Corinthians, Paul talks about judgment, about the man who is saved, but everything else he's done is burnt up. And often, all our work we work so hard and we think we've done so much for will not last into eternity. We might be saved, but our work often won't be, because it wasn't done by faith. 1 Corinthians 10 talks about the church in the desert, and they moaned, and God destroys them. And Paul says that is a warning to us about how we respond to these frustrations. And they're all very understandable, because we all experience them. So James says, guard your heart and guard your fellowship. Establish your heart towards Jesus' return and hold your tongue. Be patient. He is at the door. Remember the farmer. He is patient. And patient brings about fruit. Precious fruit. Precious fruit will come. Precious fruit will come then, if we're patient now. And patience leads to steadfastness. So that's the second thing, is steadfastness leads to blessing in verses 10 to 12. Here he talks about the end or the purpose is to see the Lord's compassion and mercy. Suffering requires patience in verse 10, which leads to steadfastness in verse 11. And he gives the example of the prophets. Now we know more about some prophets than others, but we know there's some common features, and they're all mentioned in verses 10 and 11. They suffered and were patient. They spoke in God's name, and we're to consider them blessed or happy. They remained steadfast. So there's the prophetic package. Suffer, speak for God, and be blessed. It's a great privilege to be God's spokesman, to be a prophet. But it caused great trials. And in the Bible, privilege and trial always go together. Privilege and trial. The suffering is not despite speaking God's words. How come they spoke God's words and yet they suffered? It is suffering because they spoke God's word, because they were a prophet. Just think of a few prophets that we know of. Jeremiah and Amos were persecuted by religious leaders. They were in the established church, if you like, and they were persecuted because they were told, we want to hear a softer word. You're putting people off. Give them a softer word. The problem for them was not outside of the church. They were persecuted inside of the church. Ezekiel, his ministry was started with a bereavement. Daniel was in prison and exile. Hosea had an unfaithful wife, and that experience was the message he was to deliver to Israel. All of these people, we could go on, they suffered because they were prophets. Their suffering was integral to their ministry. Now, often I hear ministers complain, and it's not something I'm innocent of in the quietness of my own home. Ministers complain about the pain of ministry. That would be like a teacher moaning about marking. And I'm not belittling the hassle of marking, but you knew it before you took the job, didn't you? Or a lorry driver moaning about the high mileage. Oh, I do so many miles. You're a lorry driver. It kind of comes with the ticket. What did you expect when you became a minister? And not only ministers. If you're in any kind of ministry, so some of you work with music and do practical things or help with the finances or work with children or do things with camps and prisons and so on. It's inviting suffering of sorts. And sometimes from the very ones you're trying to minister to. And you're thinking, I'm trying to help you. And they cause your suffering. And not only people with specific ministries, the Christian, the church, suffers. And the suffering is integral to our ministry. And yet, verse 11, we consider them blessed. Or in another translation, we call them happy. Now, verse 11 starts, behold, you know, pay attention to this. This is a surprising comment I'm going to make, he's sort of saying. We'd not want anything from that list of the prophets I just mentioned, and you may think of others that you could add, persecuted by other Christians. By other Christians. Lose a loved one. Prison, exile, be a refugee. A wife who keeps running off with other men. And yet God blesses them in the suffering. In the suffering. They are happy and blessed and privileged to be a prophet. And then James singles out Job for specific mention. We looked at Job a few years ago in the evening, if you remember him. He was the richest man in the East, and over a short period, he loses all his children, his wealth, his substantial wealth, and his health. And what does he learn from his suffering? Verse 11, the Lord is compassionate and merciful. Now, isn't that surprising? Isn't that fascinating? That Job did not learn that when he was rich, when he had lots of children, or later when he recovers. He learns it when it was taken away. And let's be clear as well that he knows, Job, the start of Job makes it absolutely clear, Job himself in his words makes it absolutely clear that he knows that God is sovereign over all of that. That God at any moment could have overruled Satan's attacks on him. It's not accidental. Job's suffering on one level is mysterious, on one level is inexplicable. But in God's hands, it is purposeful and leads to maturity and takes Job to a deeper level with God. He says, my ears had heard of you, now my eyes will see. You know, I knew factually about you, now I've experienced you, I know where we're going with this. And in some ways, this is very complex, very mysterious. Being Christ's means there's no shelter from the suffering that others experience. You're not in some special category where you don't suffer in the ways that others do. And often means exposure to more. Yet, if we remain steadfast, it leads to blessing in that very situation. And we know what James means here, don't we? Because he mentions the prophets and Job. And don't you know Christians like that? Who, even to a point, you envy them. A bit. You don't envy what happened to them, but to be like them. This week I was with another dad, and we were praying together. We were talking about some challenges that we'd faced or were facing, and we were praying, and then someone else was just talking about God's goodness through his health problems. His daughter's very seriously disabled, and they lost a child. And we just kind of looked at each other and went, that's us told, isn't it? And there were people there who had other challenges, and you think, I do not want their challenge, and I've been very clear with God about that. But it is, there's a kind of a little bit of, I wish I was a bit like them. That their happiness, not despite the sufferings, but they say it's there that they know of God's mercy and compassion. In the midst of what's going wrong, they are happy. Because they have all that matters, which is Jesus. And he can't be taken away from us. So steadfastness leads to blessing, or dare we say it, happiness. But again, there's a warning about speech in verse 12. He says, above all, my brothers, do not swear either by heaven or by earth or by any other oath, but let your yes be yes and your no be no, so that you may not fall under condemnation. Now this time the warning is different about speech. He's not talking so much about interaction with each other. He's not also here talking about speech, so it's oaths in the courtroom, I don't think. I did when I was on jury service, they give you a Bible to swear on. It's amazing. Our courts have thousands of Bibles that are never read, just for the purpose of putting your hand on. And I said I wouldn't take one, and then that invites lots of people to ask, why wouldn't you take one? And so lots of conversations about this, and where it led. But I don't think that's what he's talking about. If you've been on jury service and put your hand on the Bible and sworn to tell the truth, don't worry. What he's talking about here from the context is the situation where you are under pressure, and then you assert or affirm or promise or deny more than is realistic. Classic example is Peter following Jesus, and he's asked, are you one of his disciples? No, I'm not. And he swears he is not. He goes over the top in a direction that's not realistic. When things are difficult, when patience is wearing thin, when your steadfastness is tested, it is tempting to state more than your yes or your no. So make sure when you speak, it matches reality as you understand it, that it, that your words mean what they mean, and no more or less. Because often your words set off a chain of events that you did not mean to happen, but you did speak them, and off they go, and the snowball that that occurs because of it. And as James keeps putting it from different angles, particularly about speech, be consistent, avoid inconsistency, especially in speech, and be men and women of integrity. So be patient, it bears fruit. Be steadfast, it leads to blessing. So be active, for sure. God wants us to be actively obedient. It's great to take faith-filled, God-honoring risks. But this is the ballast for that. Do take faith-filled, God-honoring risks and be actively obedient. But God does not need your help. God does not need your help. Be active, but on God's terms. And that means being patient. How often do Christians want the right thing? But because they're impatient, because they're confused about the difference between their job and God's, they will do things, not how God says, even sin, to help him out. So that this person hears or comes or the church gets what's needed and so on. Classic example that many people have experienced it lots of times, particularly university age people, where you get a Christian girl sleeping with her non-Christian boyfriend and is desperate for him to become a Christian and will do anything for him to hear the gospel and come along, even trick him to events. And you think the one thing he needs, the one thing God is at, God doesn't need your help to convert him. But he does want your obedience in how you're meant to respond to this situation. Leave the fallout with him. And there's many situations we do that, perhaps on a smaller scale, where we act as if God needs our help. He needs us to do something other than what he's told us to do, because otherwise he'd completely stuck without us, wouldn't he? Notice patience and steadfastness needs time. If there's no time lag, there is no patience, and then there's no steadfastness. You've heard it before, haven't you, that the prayer, give me patience and give it to me now. And the irony is not lost on any of us. Patience itself needs patience. It's a time thing that grows in us and we mature in. So James' model of the Christian life is that it is slow and it takes time to mature and grow. And he doesn't use, the Bible doesn't use these illustrations of farming accidentally. I mean, they were obviously more familiar with it than us, but they're not using them by accident. Farming is not add water, leave on the shelf for 5 minutes. It takes months, years for things to grow. Time is needed. Time leads over time to fruit. And even then, we know not every seed will take. But Jesus is coming. So be patient. Stand firm. Keep going. Don't give up. Establish your heart to the future. Be steadfast in trouble. And that means guarding your impatient, frustrated words from your mouth. Let me close with this. In trouble comes blessing. In time comes fruit. In trouble comes blessing. In time comes fruit. Let's pray. Be patient, therefore, brothers, until the coming of the Lord. The coming of the Lord is at hand. Behold, the judge is standing at the door. Father, we ask that you would give us this perspective, that you have set a time when your Son will return. And so we ask that you grow in us patience, an obedient patience, and that that patience will grow in us a steadfast commitment. We ask this in his name and for your glory. Amen.